You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening and welcome. It's really wonderful to see all of you here tonight and to have heard well before that the show was booked out, sold out, or not even sold out, but booked out long before. I'm very proud to be here, very proud to be associated with Lucy and her book, and very proud indeed just to be talking about, for a change, art and not economics. I wanted to start just... but I'm afraid I am going to talk about economics. I wanted to start with a quote from John Maynard Keynes, who's someone I have a high regard for, and who wrote a wonderful essay on self-sufficiency. And he had this to say. He said, "Every day I spend my time, half vainly, but also, I must admit, half successfully, in trying to persuade my countrymen that the nation as a whole will assuredly be richer if unemployed men and machines are used to build much-needed houses than if they are supported in idleness. For the minds of this generation are still so beclouded by bogus calculations that they distrust conclusions which should be obvious, and they do so because of a reliance on a system of financial accounting, which casts doubt on whether such an operation will pay. We have to remain poor," he wrote, "because it does not pay to be rich. We have to live in hovels, not because we cannot build palaces, but because we cannot afford them. The same rule of self-destructive financial calculation governs every walk of life. We destroy the beauty of the countryside because the unappropriate splendors of nature have no economic value." Well, that's changing. They're trying to impose economic values on them. "We are capable of shutting off the sun and the stars because they do not pay a dividend. London is one of the richest cities in the history of civilization, but it cannot afford the highest standards of achievement of which its own living citizens are capable, because they do not pay. If I had the power today," he wrote, "I should most deliberately set out to endow our capital cities with all the appurtenances of art and civilization on the highest standards of which the citizens of each were individually capable, convinced that I could create, I could afford, and believing that money thus spent not only would be better than any dole or unemployment benefit, but would make unnecessary any dole. For with what we have spent on the dole in England since the war, we could have made our cities the greatest works of man in the world." And I tell you this because he was, as you know, very committed to the arts. He married a ballet dancer, he founded the Arts Theatre in Cambridge, and he bought wonderful paintings and works of art, spent a fortune on them. He helped Britain pay down her debt by buying some works of art from the French government when the French government couldn't pay. And he did a deal saying, "Well, give us a couple of your works of art." And he went and chose them himself, actually, but there's another story. So I'm so glad that we're at a point where, once again, we're talking about art and about what we're capable of being, how we're capable of being creative, and how so many people are being able to use their creativity to solve some of the big challenges facing us today. And Lucy is at the heart of that with her book. So welcome, Lucy.
Thank you, Anne. It's a very great honour to be able to speak at the RSA, but I have to say it's also an enormous honour to be chaired by Anne, so thank you. I will speak on behalf of many artists and community activists, many of whom thrillingly are in the room here tonight. But if I may, I'll begin by quoting myself. "Stepping into a new geological age called the Anthropocene, it's hard to imagine, as humans, we're accountable for reimagining our world on behalf of ourselves, subsequent generations, and all species. When facts and figures about climate change cannot catalyse the shifts needed, the arts create emergent space to rethink the future collectively. With poetry and metaphor, they explore the language of the heart, the pain of what we're losing, and the deep yearning in us for the restoration and celebration of life. We need celebratory social spaces to look backwards and forwards in time, where our collective knowledge, intuition, and a sense of wonder at what is possible can come together. That's me in a new geological age standing by art. I couldn't have written those words 5 or 6 years ago. Nightmares about the biosphere had me in a funk, fretting I was making things worse just by getting up and being human. Can artists make space for reinventing a future we can imagine being in? Can we find new ways of being human on Earth? This is a big canvas, and so I'll start with how I got to stand by art in this way. I'm a theatre maker. I ran the London International Festival of Theatre with my friend Rose Fenton, who I think is here, for 25 years. It taught me a great deal about people, place, story, and social change. Building auditoriums out in the River Thames and lighting giant flames from Bankside Power Station, we made theatre happen in unusual places at Lyft. I learnt the laws of possibility and are not fixed. They can be risked and gambled on. Between the boundary of what is possible and what is not, there's a space of transformation rich in potential for change. Such alchemy only manifests itself, though, through action, trying, failing, and trying again. How do we act in the big change stories of the planet? We lose the thread of the part we're to play. As theatre maker Zoe Svensson says, a certain scriptlessness descends. We lose our agency for making change. When the artist Emily Hinchelwood walked through Wales for a year, asking each person she met 3 questions about climate change, she discovered none of the people she met ever discussed climate change with anyone. They knew about it, but they didn't know how to act. They talked to Emily for hours, and she made their responses into a wonderful verbatim poem. My moment of scriptlessness came in 2006. I read about economic and ecological collapse till I became ill with existential scriptlessness. I couldn't imagine a future for myself, let alone a world beyond my lifetime. The personal was planetary, and I needed a new story to live by. I turned to the poets and writers, Paul Kingsnorth, co-author of the Dark Mountain Manifesto. Who can change the stories? Men and women of words, the job of the writers is to hold on to truth and to tell it as powerfully as they can. A lot of opportunity, says storyteller Martin Shaw, is going to arrive in the next 20 years, disguised as loss. Opportunity was the ground beneath my feet in Tooting, South London. I got involved in grassroots transition movement, modelling change in how you live, where you live, connecting communities across the globe to imagine a world beyond fossil fuels, beyond what Brett Bloom calls our petro-subjectivity, a sense of self comprehensively enmeshed in fossil fuels. I was reclaiming what designer Chris Thornton describes as the potential of being as act. Action, he says, reminds us of our innate potential for choice, making real the things we value. Where action is socialised or collaborative, the sense of connection and responsibility to others encourages it to continue. Making real the things we value where I lived was a place of play. 2 events taught me much. 1 huge, the Trash Catchers Carnival, which took to the high road, inviting the town to imagine a low-carbon future for Tooting. The other, more intimate, the Encounters Transition Shop. This empty shop with nothing for sale but lots on offer invited people to leave a trace of themselves, creating what Encounters' Ruth Benthoven calls a remote dialogue across Tooting generations and cultures. It was magical and made connection between people's greatest hopes and deepest fears about what it is like to live now. In both events, I saw capacities of the human heart to engage with the knowledge of global challenges, with a yearning for a narrative of change, I saw people thinking, if we can do this, we can do anything. I saw we could reclaim a more livable world, but only if we'd the space to first imagine it. The participatory arts became charged for me in new ways, with this practice of a great imagining, with living within ecological limits and community at its heart. Artists use the word practice, but it's one that everyone can use to describe a daily life that combines creativity and intentional change. This was life as a citizen artist, what art critic Susie Gablett calls the re-enchanting of our culture, where personal and collective creativity connect to social, moral, ethical, and ecological responsibility. Not responsibility for the world in general, but one that is specific and practical and different for each one of us. The line between community activism and art, art making and community making, got blurry. It was a new definition of theatre and dramaturgy for me. Finding stories in a form that could be acted, finding scripts, creating everyday parts for people to play. My book, Playing for Time, sprang from a desire to better understand the role our imaginations and creative skills play in imagining a world in which life on Earth is cherished and sustained. The book makes a case for play, the ground of art's being, and how we and other mammals learn what we need to know to survive. In our imaginations, we rehearse possible futures, saying, if that happens, I'll do that. We draw on these memories of the future to make decisions about how to act in the real world. Play opens us to creativity and change, extending the range of possibilities we draw on. But play can be disrupted by fear, which our present dangers elicit. Artists re-engineer time to allow our imaginations to flourish, glimpsing other ways of seeing and feeling. This is liminal space, where nothing's fixed and anything becomes possible. And we return from this parallel universe, imaginary universe, subtly altered and sometimes forever. And it's from these experiences that different futures can emerge. Yet, we're on a finite trajectory in terms of time. Atmospheric CO2 levels are higher than at any time in the past 800,000 years. Decision makers from 190 nations convene in Paris in 12 days' time to agree on how levels are reduced. The Coming of Age programme, part of ArtCOP21 internationally, demonstrates the movement in the UK cultural sector to respond creatively to the urgency of climate change. Platform London, Cape Farewell, Tipping Point, Julie's Bicycle, Arts Admin, and many others, including here at the RSA, lead a step change in embracing such responsibility. Artists can be circuit breakers, speeding up a public process of seeing and feeling the truth of climate change. It can feel counterintuitive at such a time to play, but the arts help us learn what we need to know to survive. They can be taken very seriously. In writing this book, big book, I was joined by 60-plus artists and activists. A core group met in Yorkshire at Arvon's Writing Centre, Lumbank, to lay its first tracks. We looked for patterns of a transitional arts practice, an intention to bring about change, to frame, facilitate, collaborate, and the invisible art of holding space. The principles we unearthed are modest on their own, but in combination and in an explicit context of collapsing ecological systems, they create momentum for a narrative of change. Not easy to categorise, this was art emerging chameleon-like in the spaces in between people and places, joining dots between the macro drivers of change in energy, finance, climate change, food and community resilience, and the micro stories of creative practice. Few fell into categories of dance, music, or the visual arts, or art that could be purchased or consumed. Paying attention, disrupting, growing food, planting trees, making theatre, creating ceremony, digging clay, walking, building cairns. These were creative skills for building connection between ourselves, our communities, and the natural world. All were aligned to deeply held values and accountabilities. Many made work with people who'd not previously identified themselves as artists, and often what was created between people was the art, familiar to anyone rooted in traditions of relational, socially and ecologically engaged art, or social sculpture. From citizen artists as agents of change, from Joseph Beuys through to Shelley Sachs today. Such art could be found in theatres and galleries, but you'd be more likely to find it in apiaries, playgrounds, hospitals, community gardens, or on bandstands, shorelines, and mountaintops. Four narratives created the edges of the book: a super narrative of earth, a grand narrative of drama and action, the biographical personal narratives we all bring to the story, and one that formed the central practice of the book, the communal narrative, informing a practice of community and collective agency for change. Artists, said Sarah Woods, give communities, audiences, people involved, a relationship to the idea of change. The artwork itself is about change and has a relationship to change. It's about participation, about people being active. Artists pay close attention to things. Sometimes that alone changes everything. This is at Transition Heathrow, where a protest focused on the third runway evolved into an ongoing creative community. And here's Doogie Strang playing Wolf on Scotland's Rannoch Moor, making a connection to land. Camping in the cold, he surprised train travellers crossing the remote area in his mask and fake fur coat bought on eBay. If wolves were to be brought back, Rannoch Moor's a good place to start. In a fleeting glimpse from the train, people might ask, why a wolf? Why there? Here are some mythic creatures emerging from their natural habitat to rove across the land. This is Amy Sharrock's Swim. 50 people swam across pools of London, exploring physical and metaphysical connections to water. This is what Amy calls the architecture of a moment, made between people. Some of you will be familiar with her recent Museum of Water, gathering the public's own donations of water that is precious to them. Activism per se covers a very broad spectrum, from a front line of creativity and resistance. This is the laboratory of insurrectionary imaginations, rebel clown army some years ago at the G8 summit. And John Jordan, part of the climate games in Paris in December, proposes that art is about transforming reality, not representing it. Liberate Tate's Human Cost here at the Tate, which is sponsored by BP, marked the anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon explosion. Images like this carry poetic power, raising questions about fossil fuel sponsorship of the arts and culture. And it's worth noting, the Museum Association has recently updated its code of ethics, advising museum workers to, quote, exercise due diligence in understanding the ethical standards of commercial partners with a view to maintaining public trust and integrity in all museum activities. The influential arts activists platform have consistently traced lines of accountability between corporations, social injustice, and ecological destruction. And I attended just last week the vigil outside Shell's South Bank headquarters to mark the 20th anniversary of the execution of playwright activist Ken Sarawiwa and the Ogoni Nine, who protested Shell's devastation of the lands and livelihoods in the Niger Delta. And the activist spectrum includes also the everyday activism of Eva Bakislet, working with microorganisms to reclaim living cultures in yogurt, kefir, and here, Finnish vili. Eva celebrates culture's resilience, microbial and social, when fermented, exchanged, and shared. Here, with Swedish artist Cultivator, she leads bread baking culture workshops with newly arrived refugees from Syria, exchanging knowledge and growing culture's resilience. In marking change, we accelerate change with ceremony and rites of passage, with links to past, present, and future. This is the cairn for lost species on the Sussex Downs. Andreas Kornevall, its creator, says, we express something new under the modern sun, the ability to grieve for other species. Opportunities as loss. Ceremonies mark seasons with harvests, wassails, and here in Ulverston, Cumbria, a lantern parade to connect people in the darkening days of autumn, an ancient ceremony invented not so long ago by artists Welfare State International. And celebrating Garlic Man at summer solstice in New Cross, on land once covered in orchards and market gardens, Bridget McKenzie says, "These projects mixing food and creativity show how wildness can sustain us and connect us to our past." Amy Shelton honours honeybees, tracking nectar and pollen-bearing plants to map a bee year chronologically into an exquisite installation, Florilegium. And Clayground Collective renews people's engagement with clay, celebrating its role in cultures around the world and at a cutting edge of technology. At the Icon Gallery in Birmingham, several thousand people one weekend got stuck into a ton of clay. The collective's Thinking Hands research investigates haptic skills from haptikos pertaining to our sense of touch in interpreting the world, thinking, learning, and imagining the future. Roger Lemon, a neurophysiologist, said, "There are 10 times as many channels of information feeding back from your hands to your brain as there are channels going out from your brain to your hands. With materials of all kinds in our hands, we see ahead to what we can create. We gain mastery and agency. The brains in our fingers are key to facing an unknowable future. Fixing, repairing, maintaining, reskilling is where the action is. How many of you, I wonder, have recently been to a bicycle maintenance workshop, a repair cafe, a restart party? A haptic revolution taking place the length and the breadth of the country acknowledges how unskilled we've become. It meets a hunger for reskilling and self-reliance and marks a significant reconnection with the material world beyond conspicuous consumption. Our hands liberate us from a disposal culture and build on long, long traditions of heritage skills of craftsmanship, from lace making to hedge making to boat building." This is the paper apothecary at the Beanie House of Art and Knowledge in Canterbury, a commission from the Happy Museum, which explores how the museum sector connects to our own well-being and that of the planet. Happiness prescriptions are being written out here for visitors who locate their treatments in the gallery. What makes us happy, these museums are discovering, is flow, making, engaging, connecting, learning, and being active citizens. Happiness becomes a Trojan horse for decoupling our prosperity and well-being from limitless economic growth. Far Player pays attention to the physical world of our bodies. Anshuman Biswas draws a line in sound with audible signals passed from person to person, like a dawn chorus sweeping the globe to explore the unimaginable space we find ourselves in. And in Bedside Manners, artist Sophie Layton with Anna Ledyard worked at the Evelina London Children's Hospital, making space for parents to sew and embroider images, the part of the body or organ that related to their child's illness. Sophie recorded conversations with parents and staff about the hours spent sitting beside their poorly children. Here, nurses listen to that soundscape set in an installation like a child's bedroom. The aesthetics of care, found in so much of this work, shows a sense of vulnerability is common to us all. To speed up change, we need paradoxically to slow down. And projects with food and food growing at their heart make space for this, connecting to seed time, earthworm time, sun and moon time. In Encounter's little patch of ground, a group gathered across ages and cultures and meeting weekly, they studied the principles of permaculture, earth care, people care, and fair share, to grow a garden, cook and share food, and finally create a public performance based on both their joys and concerns for the world. In a field of wheat, Anne-Marie Culhane and Ruth Levine have just planted 22 acres of wheat in Lincolnshire, the breadbasket of England. They've recruited a collective of individuals from different backgrounds to invest money in the project, who, along with farmer Peter Lundgren, will learn about pest control, the complexities of the food system, and how to sell the harvested wheat on the financial markets. we learn about the wheat system shaped by sun and rain, and the one shaped by globalised trading systems. On the Boundary Estate in Shoreditch, families and friends play the table game of carom on the reclaimed bandstand at Arnold Circus. Nassim Khan, a neighbourhood player in the area, says a desire to tidy up and weed was a simple intervention that opened the door to far grander things, a wholesale transformation of the circus. Long-term scenario planner Barbara Heinsohn proposes that societies learn through fostering qualities of neighbourliness. Neighbourliness developed under certain conditions, experiment and engagement, with intimacy and diversity, project by project over time. Crossing boundaries of age, culture, gender, knowledge and working expertise, we rehearse the social reinvention we need. Playing for Time has such rehearsals and recipes for action. How to organise a land journey, how to know your place on the oil road, ferment kefir, hold a broad gathering in your community on subjects such as fracking or food sovereignty. No one person's practice is reproducible, but there are invitations here to have a go, the music of what happens. The late great cultural theorist Stuart Hall distinguished between globalisation from above and globalisation from below. Globalisation from above was imposed economically, militarily, and culturally, with an attendant amnesia of empire. A homogenising force, it drives the world towards injustice, conflict, and the polarisation of wealth and resources. It moves freely and is without commitments and must be resisted. Globalisation from below celebrates diversity, is people-led, makes alliance across differences. It leads to interdependence, attachment, commitment. It needs visible space on the ground as a dynamic place for people to live together, belonging to societies that are inclusive, pluralistic, multicultural and fair. Space on the ground, where our collective knowledge, intuition and wonder at what's possible can come together. And the participatory arts afford that. Blueprints exist of how societies can transition to low-carbon futures. The Centre for Alternative Technologies' Who's Getting Ready for Zero needs to sit on every decision-maker's table in Paris. But there's no collective map of how they're invented socially or how a cultural commons is created for the future we want and can find our place in. Drawing on patterns of belonging, empathy, kindness, community resilience, stewardship, reskilling, alternatives to limitless growth, the arts energise people's capacities for action, activate their skills, and transform their capabilities. These practices must grow resilient in response to the radical changes required to live within ecological limits. Their celebratory social spaces have power to build this resilience and reinvent us. They hold the things we care about. Give us moments to begin again from, extend our imagination, collective courage and knowledge we're part of a larger whole. Has public debate fully recognised the role the arts and culture play in accelerating, nurturing change for a sustainable future? Not quite. Yet these creative practices can draw on the perspectives of everyone to create a future we want to live in. Their metaphors, dreams, disruptions and symbolism provide that other space from which a new exploration of the self and the world can emerge and an unshakable belief that change can and does happen. In studies of systemic interconnectedness, the energy and resilience of a system are where connections and links are the strongest, participation, diversity, plurality and variability the greatest. The dualities of an adversarial culture fall away when contradiction and opposites are explored holistically. Sorrow and gladness, isolation and connection, problems and solutions. Transitional arts practice simply manifests and gives expression to the participatory universe of which we're a part. So art has a purpose. It serves the restoration and celebration of life. Although, says Susie Gablick, the notion of art being in service to anything might be anathema. There's a plaque on the wall outside that says, RSA, for the encouragement of art, manufacturing and commerce. Encourage carries the word cur inside it, heart. Making art as if the world mattered needs encouragement. For all its joys, it's not easy. It demands ingenuity, skill, generosity, humour, devotion even. But it's not going away. I feel it's arriving to play its full part. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I feel encouraged. And I'm going to end with an extract from the chapter on home. Finding a way to belong on earth is the most radical thing any of us can do, individually and collectively. When Felix Baumgarten jumped to earth from a helium balloon 39,000 metres high up in the stratosphere recently, he said, "I'm going home now." In an act of hubris in 1963, having just learnt to swim, I put the armbands I no longer needed onto my ankles. As I tried to right myself, flailing around with both feet in the air and my head underwater, I learnt there and then I didn't belong under the water. Felix and I, in our own ways, were experimenting with the edges of the biosphere, the place on Earth where life dwells. Whilst sea creatures exist deep beyond the reach of the sun's rays, and there are birds nesting high up on ice in the Andes, most of the planet's species live just under or above the ground or in a top layer of the ocean. For humans, our comfortable home is the broad band of breathable air beneath blue sky, where the sunlight, water, soil, and materials we can make our homes from. Mars, Earth's planet neighbour, has evidence of water, but not green grass, whales, earthworms, pomegranates, rainwater, frangipani trees, forget-me-nots, or bees. Or, I might add, an abundance of citizen artists and artist citizens building connection to this planet, this pale blue dot. That's home. That's us.
Thank you, Lucy, for a quite poetic speech, I thought. It was really beautiful. And I noticed you were all quite transfixed. So thank you, Lucy. And by the way, I forgot to mention that Lucy's dad, Michael, has come all the way from Powers to be with us tonight. And I want to thank him for that. Right, now we have time for questions.
Hello, I'm Isao Nascimento. And I'd like to know how you can create a diverse society and have it at the same time a common denominator that unites people.
Peter O'Sullivan, yeah.
And I'm involved on the edge of a new project in Southampton. Anybody here from Southampton? Yeah, well, I'm from Winchester. Where we are very proud of the fact that we're going to have a purpose-built new arts centre next year. Other than knocking it down, what would Lucy do with it to turn it into an agent of change?
Ha-ha, good question. Question from over there, that lady, yes?
Thank you. Yes, woman. Rowan Dodds, Small is Beautiful. I just have a comment rather than a question. I just want to say thank you very, very much for that. It feels like you've opened a door in your articulation of each of those different huge areas, along with ideas from artists. I can now start to think of all the different artists that I've worked with in different ways, in a completely different way. And I feel like you've opened up something that cannot go back down in a box tonight. So I would love to have a copy of your talk, and I want to send it to every member of Parliament, a member of the Scottish Parliament. So thank you.
So as that was a comment and not a question, we could have another question if anyone had one. Yes.
Hi, I'm Jack. I was going to ask Lucy maybe for some tips on like engagement with people, like when you're doing programmes like this, how to get the biggest involvement instead of, if you're, it's quite easy to attract people that are maybe socially aware already or
like like-minded
or white and middle class or whatever you want to say it. But how, if she's got any tips for getting more people involved.
Well, thank you, Rowan, for that statement. That's extremely encouraging. I don't think there are any rules, and I think that everybody's context and location and story, if you like, is different. But what the artists in Playing for Time in their own ways are all describing is the potential to... Ruth Benthoven has a particular phrase that she uses where she talks about the art of invitation being absolutely fundamental to the beginning and the process of any project, which is that how people hear about what you're doing, how you invite them, how you... I mean, it's a difficult term, but this holding space is... It is an invisible art, but it's a really fascinating invisible art about how you frame and hold a space within a project that allows people to feel that they can enter it, they can participate in it, they can be open, they can be themselves in it.
And money doesn't have to change hands?
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it does. But the question about the plurality and the diversity, I think, is that there is a manner in which there is potential for the broadest range of people, whatever their own circumstances, whatever their backgrounds are, you know, and certainly not to be encumbered by the idea that this is an art project and they're going to be artists in it, that there's simply something that is a way of... I mean, actually, I feel here I'm sort of talking about people who are all in the room, and I feel I would like to ask Sarah Woods or Anne-Marie Collane or Anna Ledyard or Julia Roundtree. These are all practicing... practitioners who spend a lot of their time, you know, inviting people to dig clay or inviting people to come into the Empathy Roadshow or shows that have been put on. There was a question about the Southampton, about knocking down the building. No, I don't think buildings that are there should be knocked down. I think buildings are wonderful things. And, you know, a building can be a host and a home to everything that has to happen in terms of what gets created, what... dialogues are had, what processes are, you know. I think what's interesting to observe is the way, if there is a host and they have a building, is the way in which they're engaging with people immediately around. So
and
that
so
the host
how,
is a, ne- you know, the neighbourliness goes
the
on around that building.
The openness of the building, yeah.
Yeah, and that people feel that they can have a home there and that they can belong there. And you don't kind of draw a line and say, well, this is our neighbourhood, because obviously you invite other people. But I think that a building that you enter and you feel you belong there, wherever you've come from, is a building that has a set of values about convening and gathering and hosting and allowing extraordinary things to happen there.
Lucy, do you think we should offer some of these artists to have a word? Or do any of them want to?
Yes. Well, Sarah's just been on the road with them.
I was just going to respond to... Jack,
sorry. The idea of what tips there are for not always speaking to the same selection of people. And I think I think it's something we've talked about, Lucy, the idea of meeting people where they are is really important. That we, you know, we have a position, we have our views and the things that we want to communicate. And in my experience, and I do a lot of sort of road shows of going out on the road and taking work to people. And Josh Fox, who did Gasland, the recent films about fracking in America, said the most powerful thing he feels he's done is get on a bus with a group of people and just go round and talk to people. And I think it's that level of human connection that's very an important part of this sort of work.
Great. Good. I was at Wembley last night for the French football match, French-English, and it really made... I don't often go to football matches, but it made me realise that there's a huge part of British culture there. When I heard them sing, first of all these blokes singing God Save the Queen with great gusto, and then singing the French national anthem, Marseillaise, it was incredibly moving. But we don't talk about that as culture or popular culture, which is what it is. Anyway, and next question over there, the gentleman in the blue.
Thank you, Rick Hall. Thanks, Lucy. Great talk. I want to just make one observation and then a question about reaching out to other parts of cultural life. The observation is around Homo Ludens, the book by Johann Weitzinger, written in 1938 in the face of fascism moving across Europe, and the role of play. You touched on play as being an important part of the cultural life of communities. The question is reaching across to other aspects of culture, and I'm very interested in the maker movement, the craft movement, the hackspace movement. And I just wonder if there is a new definition of artist in residence, scientist in residence, engineer in residence in community groups that might be of value for agents of change.
Yes, very interesting talk, Lucy. It's a question to do with your, if you like, academic background. How influenced are you by Pierre Bourdieu's idea of habitus? In other words, the creation of individual incidents in which people's collective experience is made and it then goes on to inform other similar experiences elsewhere.
Hello, Lucy. It's
Hello,
David. I just had a really simple question about the making of the book, and I wondered if you could tell us if you could go and visit the Lucy Neal that I remember from 3 years ago when the book was a twinkle in her eye, what would you say to her about the process of collaboratively coming up with this tome?
Sarah, can I just ask about shops, small shops and independent shopkeepers and that part of society and what we think we're losing through some of this globalised brand around the world that are reducing some of the high streets and some of the public spaces, as it were, into much more homogeneous and boring places, and what you can say about that.
Lucy, those
can
are...
Can I work backwards?
Yeah, and there's such big... There's such big questions, but I want you to be concise as
possible.
Yeah,
shops, I'd say... I just think there's so much reinvention going on. If you look within, there's a new transition book called 21 Stories of Transition, and just the sheer ingenuity and creativity that's going into local economies and incredible creative communities, whether it's bakeries or... Yes, there is this kind of homogenising force, but I think with it there's a kind of dizzying expansion of hundreds of new initiatives and enterprises and things like that. That was one.
It was the point about the French social theorist.
Yes. Okay. I went to school, I got A-levels, I went to university, I got a good degree in Italian literature and language and English. And that, I think, is pretty much my academic background in a formal sense. So I have spent my life experimenting with practice, and I, quite frankly... not very good at coming up with the relative theories to things. And one of the things I say in the book, which I think is important to say, is that I don't feel we currently have joined the dots with the research which is out there and can be joined in terms of the work of the participatory arts within the frame that I've outlined in terms of this moment that we're living in planetarily. But it's there. You know that we explore the real world through the imaginary. You know, we know about transitional objects. We know about how we build meaning through the arts. And there's a lot of systems theory that gives us how we can act to make systemic change. But, I mean, I would love to see that research kind of added up.
And...
Oh, David.
Making the book.
You think you're going to drown, but actually, don't worry, you're not.
And, I think
you
that's
know,
a
there were
good
lots of
answer.
Others. There were lots of others, and many are here in the room.
Right, we have a couple more minutes.
There was one about crop.
A Twitter question, sure.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm the RSA staff tweeter tonight, and we've had a question from Nick Jeune, who says... is this a wonderful collection of the fringe, and how does it become the mainstream?
Aha. Challenging, as always.
that smacks of adversarial culture to me. I think we've moved beyond seeing things as either this or this, you know, the fringe or the mainstream. I think that this work is already radically changing so many perceptions and stories and localities and communities.
So the fringe is not the fringe?
It feels an old way of demarking, you know, something that exists here, up here, and something that is widespread and over there, and the idea of things seeding at the margins and, you know, innovating. I just feel we're in a slightly different ball game at the moment.
Good,
I think
glad.
I think a lot of it is about relocalization, which is an inevitable consequence of some of the changes that are going to happen. And so it's getting our heads around what that means and how we grow. And, you know, resilience is a very important thing for us to be learning, you know, in terms of changes already coming.
I like that answer.
Okay, Judy Lingwall.
Hello.
I feel that, Lucy, this book is a real moment, I think, what you have put together. And this is a question for both the RSA and for yourself. How can the RSA support you in reaching the unconverted that hold the power to build a better framework for artists to make their contribution?
Well, I think that would be for the RSA to respond. Yeah. I'm not sure the RSA is ready to respond, but I cannot speak on its behalf.
I would like to thank Lucy for using, as I call it, children's terminology, because learning, what is learning? Play, children's terminology to me, and what do we learn? Are we too old to learn? And I would hope that within the book, which my colleagues bought me, that I will learn what you understand by learning and opening up to whatever it might be, the future. Thank you.
I'm Portia.
Hello, Portia.
So, Paris Climate Conference, what would you tell your collaborators, your fellow artists, what are you thinking about, you know, the hashtag Earth to Paris? I mean, what can we tell our children, our families, what can we do in these coming weeks? This is a really important thing that's about to happen in this terribly troubled place.
I think there are a lot of different things you can be doing. Anne-Marie was telling me this morning about something happening on Dartmoor. The transition movement is really just trying to make visible all the things that are already happening now, all the modelling of changes that is already going on now. You know, it's not, please, can you fix this? But these things are happening now. Platform are organising a festival at the Tate, you know, without permission, which will go ahead about, you know, where that relationship with fossil fuels is and the fact that it's in the middle of the climate change talks. There's going to be a lot of creative action everywhere. But I would say, look where you are. There'll be something near where you are. There's a big march on Sunday, the 29th.
Here, what about in London. What about the 500 bloggers?
Charlotte, quickly, Charlotte, where are you? Tell us about Paris and the bloggers.
Yes, I'm taking part of a sort of blog-in in Paris, and about 500 bloggers from around the world are going to convene and rewrite the story of change. It's an experiment. There are speakers every night, different speakers about different aspects of our global crises that we're involved in, and different ways of just looking at it and basically exchanging information. Lucy talks about, you know, working in systems is also exchanging information and gathering and convening, and a lot of the book is about that and spaces and opportunities that we can do that. So I hope that will be happening in Paris.
That will be exciting.
You'll see us on the web. Okay.
Right. We have only about 3 minutes left, so a question from there. Yep.
Right. Hi, Lucy. I've just had a thought. Do you know Stella Duffy and the Fun Palaces? Just because that's a great and kind of flourishing project, and I know that, well, it's a socially engaged kind of wonderful range of socially engaged activity, and she's interested in environmental and climate-related activities as part of that. So it seems like it could be a very good...
I do, and I think that the beautiful thing about the fun palaces,
yeah,
is this idea, is everyone an artist, everyone a scientist?
Yeah.
And I've just remembered a question that didn't really get answered, which was this idea that I absolutely believe, and Paul Allen from the Centre for Alternative Technology would agree with me now, is that we need interdisciplinary practice, but we also need interdisciplinary policy, you know, for our silos to begin to kind of join up and look at what systemic change is. And therefore, I think the more artists we have resident in engineering departments and the more engineers we have resident in art centres, and that, you know, Barbara Heinsohn's point about societies learn through engagement and experimentation, but it's a cross-working expertise, it's a cross-knowledge, and it's how we make the spaces for that to come together so that we have the absolute maximum number of people's perspectives. Everyone gets to have a say in the kind of future and society it is that we want to live in. It's about reclaiming our right to say this is the society we'd like to live in, and that's Paul Allen with his hand up there.
Right, Paul.
One of the things that we're thinking about in Paris is we actually are taking, as you suggested, the Who's Getting Ready for Zero report to Paris, and we've made it available for everybody. And one of the things that you can do is download it and have a look. We've found 100 scenarios from around the world that show we can get to zero emissions within the timescale demanded by the science, but we need to reinvent and reinterpret and bring it to life and take people there and help people live it and love in it. And
yeah.
Thank you.
I think that's a wonderful note on which to end. Can I say that the book, as I understand it, is outside, and signed copies, I imagine, are available. To encourage you to talk about the book, talk about the issues, and I agree that this is a moment, and thank you, Lucy, for creating this moment. And talk about it and share it, and also talk about the RSA's role in making this a very much bigger issue in our society and here in London. And so can I invite you all to thank our wonderful author. They love you, Lucy, they love you. And then can I thank the RSA and Alex in particular for pulling all this together. It's never easy and we're very grateful.
And also Vicky, because Vicky extended the invitation. We're going to close the evening with Selina Nwulu, who is our young poet laureate for London. And a lot of what we've been thinking about this evening is about how we imagine ourselves as other. And this short poem of Selina's, Two Sides of a Coin, I hope, will send us on our way. Selina.
Thank you for the invitation. There's a girl who looks like me, walking through the streets of Lagos. She is freshly put mangoes and forehead beads of sweat. She is flat shoes and a head wrap on Sundays. She is a collision of patterns chasing each other. She looks like me, but her vowel sounds have shrunk. There are no Yorkshire undertones here. Instead, she speaks in half songs, rolls Igbo off her tongue like blooming hibiscus, and wears her ancestors' sayings on her chest like armour. She weaves through this downtown scene in fluid choreography, the joke thrown to the passing neighbour, the pause and smell of the pile of peppers in the market. Each act has a home in this moving composition. You can see her belonging in the sway of her hips. If you look closely enough, you can see how her shoulders sigh like mine, can hear her life in the drag of her flat feet and feel their tendency to wonder. We both laugh with the weight and depth of a church bell. On a good day, it will throw our heads back. Sometimes I see these two versions of myself like two sides of a coin, heads here, tails over there. I wonder why the coin landed on this side. I wonder which version would have laughed the most. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.